What I'm going to argue today is that language is important. Also in this situation, a strong speaking voice is important, and I've lost at least half my voice. I've got a lot more than I had on Wednesday, so please bear with me on that. But what I want to talk about today is language, and I think language is very important. At Vine Church, we think a lot about certain things. We give a lot of thought to things like spaces, making sure our spaces look nice and are pretty and work well and are functional. I'm always blown away by the sort of care we put into posters and postcards and leaflets and things like that, and putting out a spread at the Christmas party. We do a really good job on presentation and things like that, and our music and look and feel. But I think we should also think about our language. And when I talk about language, I'm just talking about words and phrases and how we communicate those words and phrases. Very simple things. It's nothing particularly tricky there. And if you think of the different spheres in your life, you've got your friends, you've got your family, you've got your workmates, you might play in a sporting team and things like that. Each one of those spheres of your life has its own culture. And as a result, it has its own words that you use in them. And so the way that you talk to your mother is probably different to the way that you talk and the language you use to talk to your people at work. And certainly in my case, it's certainly different to the language and the words you use to talk to the guys you play footy with. And of all those different languages, all those different ways of speaking, my contention is that Christian language has got to be the most weird thing that we use of anything, you know, in all the different spheres of life. I know that some things can be a little bit crass and crude on a footy field, but nothing is quite as weird as what goes on in church. I think in general, our church is actually quite good at avoiding this. I think, I was saying to Tobes before, I think the series on Judges of it has been particularly good at avoiding that sort of thing. But I don't know if anyone else finds this, that church can be just kind of weird in the language you use, the things that you can say and get away with, things that people say that are sort of treated as a perfectly normal phrase. I remember I had a minister who was years ago, who was otherwise a sort of reasonably sort of knockabout Australian guy. But when he used the word holy, he would always say, holy. And it was just a weird thing. And because he was a minister, everyone tolerated it. Everyone thought that was kind of normal in some ways. And I just think it's bizarre. I love my Bible study group, my community group. A lot of the people are here from that today. But I even noticed that at that group that we have dinner every, if you don't have dinner, you should have dinner at your community group. We have dinner for about an hour at the table. And it's great. And then we clear the plates away and we have the study, and you notice there's this subtle change in the way that you talk about things. That you might say, oh, I got a new job, and that was great. And it becomes, I got a new job, oh, I'm very thankful for that. You know, it just becomes these tiny little things that just creep in, and they're just a little bit weird. And I think we need to de-weird our language and de-weird the language you use at church. And I think in this, we're not always particularly well served by Bible translations. This is a translation from one of my favourite books of the Bible, Jonah. Who likes the story of Jonah? Don't read the whole story. But don't read the whole quote, but just get the scene. This is a bunch of sailors. Has everyone met a sailor before? Everyone hung out at the docks before? Sailors. I used to play footy with a bunch of guys from the Navy. Sailors are a particular type of people. And they're on a small boat, probably the size of where you're sitting, you know, and a whole bunch of people in there, and it's a storm, and it's to the point that they're going to have a human sacrifice so that they don't drown. And this is what it's translated as, what they say. Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. Who thinks sailors actually talk like that in that sort of situation? Now, I'm not trying to say that this is an unfaithful Bible translation. I'm sure the translators worked really hard on this. But that's not how it works. You know, that misses the sort of tone of what's going on and misses the spirit. It's a bit like the sermon that Toby preached 2 weeks ago about Ehud and Eglon. You know when you get that Bible reading voice and you treat everything as incredibly sort of solemn? This story is clearly meant to be read around a campfire. I kept banging on about the campfire in our community group. You can see that this is a story that would have been passed on from generation to generation over a meal, over some drinks, when everyone would have had a good laugh about the whole thing. And we often miss that sort of tone. We miss that sort of thing because we treat everything as so solemn. It's serious, but we treat it as solemn, and we need to sort of differentiate between those two things. I don't know if anyone knows who Clive James is, the Australian, you know, writer, and he's a very funny guy, but he's a writer, and he always talks about, you know, he never does anything that's billed as being funny. He said the only time is to be funny is in a serious situation. And I think we have a similar thing with church, that, you know, we end up being solemn all the time when it's just serious. That's all. It doesn't have to be solemn. So why do we end up? Why do we end up doing this? And I think fundamentally, we all have a need to fit in. We're all relational people, and we all want to fit into the group. And the need to fit in is very common in sort of whatever circle you're part of. You know, no one wants to be the heretic in the group, and it's particularly I think important in church that we don't want to be that person. And you know, even if you are sort of countercultural, you tend to want to be countercultural in a sort of conformist way. And so what ends up happening in church is we construct this sort of Christian safe space that I call it, where we spend our time together and we end up sort of just muttering the same platitudes that are just kind of slightly plastic Christian sounding phrases and cliches. You know, and if someone has a problem, you know, we say, I'll pray for you. Does anyone believe that they're actually about to go and pray for you? Or sometimes if it's Toby, of course, everyone's good. But, you know, or you know, you have a discussion where someone doesn't, you know, there's disagreement at the end and someone says, well, I'll have to pray about that, or I'll have to wrestle about that. Or you've got an issue and someone says, well, you just need to trust God about that. And you think, what does that actually mean? Does anyone know what that means? And it's very safe. It's very inclusive. We all want to know what people are saying, but it's not, I don't think it's particularly helpful. And ultimately, church becomes this sort of insider's game. Now, at Vine, we are really against sort of any sort of insiderism, if that's a word. So, you know, I notice little things like our kids' ministry. For example, on Sunday mornings, every week, we make an announcement about where the kids' ministry is, and we explain that there are trained leaders who are going to look after it. You know, most of the people who are going to that, in fact, almost everyone, almost every week, has been there before. They know all that sort of stuff. But we say it again and again because we don't want to exclude anyone. And I think that's a really noble goal, that we don't want to exclude anyone. But when we do this thing of saying lots of Christian cliches, or Christianese, as some people call it, we end up using all these loaded phrases that can be massively exclusive or, you know, non-inclusive to people who don't know what's going on. And this struck me, I remember a couple of months ago at church, and I hope I'm not picking on someone who's here, or if they are, that they're wearing their big boy pants and could take it. But there was a baptism that happened at church, and there were a whole bunch of people who were there, and you could tell that they were at church either for the first time in their life or the first time in a long time. The fact they wear a suit gives it away that they don't come to church particularly often. And a baptism, a situation like that, is one of the few times that they're going to be in church and hear a long talk, you know, one of those long Toby Neal sermons that go on. You know, they might come to weddings from time to time and you get a sort of shorter sermon, but, you know, at a wedding, it's generally about the couple and things like that, whereas they're going to sit through a long sermon. Now, what level does the average person off the street, what level of biblical literacy do they have? Two generations ago, would have had a lot. One generation ago, they would have picked up on a lot of the main points. These days, most people walk into that room with almost no biblical literacy. In fact, about the, you know, you could talk about the cross, wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about. You can talk about the blood of the lamb, they wouldn't know what that is. They would have, you would have sang songs, they may have sang the song, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, worship his holy name," and not known what a single one of those words actually meant. Like every one of those words is a loaded term, and all of those things would have gone over their head. I think to that insider, the one concept that they would have had when they walked into the room was God. I think it's probably the last remaining bit of generally accepted biblical literacy that most people understand, that Christians believe in a creator God. Most people still know the first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in this sermon, whoever it was preaching spoke almost exclusively about Yahweh. They didn't say God, they said Yahweh. And I just thought it was a tragedy that the one remaining link that they would have had between their experience in the world and coming into a church was severed because we wanted to use the technical bit of jargon of Yahweh rather than using God. Does everyone understand? Now, I realize that may offend some people's sensibilities, but that really struck me. And I think one of the reasons I think this is important is we play like we train. I don't know, Jordan, I'm sure you've yelled this out at different coaching sessions. One thing that's always important in sport is that you should always train hard because it's going to be hard in the game on Saturday. And if you just get to training on Tuesday and Thursday night and you just faff around and muck about and have a laugh, then you get absolutely smashed when you get out there and play the game. And for me, I think church is actually not like a game. Church is like training. Life is the game. Life is where you get belted up and beaten up, and life is where you're going to be put under pressure. And if we gather at church and if we tolerate plastic phrases, if we tolerate cliches and things like that, then when we're actually challenged, all we've got to come back against that is cliche and things like that. And I think we're really going to suffer, and I don't think it's particularly authentic. And I think, you know, when we get to talk to someone, if, you know, what's in, you know, what's in our holster is a bunch of cliches, people are sensitive to that these days. People will see through that sort of thing straight away. And so you might make the allegation that what I'm advocating is that we dumb down church, that we kind of make it stupid, or that we make it simple and we don't look for complicated ideas. But I don't think that's what I'm advocating at all. You know, ultimately we need to ask, what are we trying to do? Now, I'm pretty sure we had a discussion early on in this church, you know, what's the overriding goal of this church? I think we said it was proclamation. We said we want to go and proclaim the gospel. And to me, that's what proclaiming the gospel often looks like. It's a guy with all the right cliches, with all the right words, who shouts into a vacuum. And I don't know if that's exactly what you want to do. I think persuasion is actually more what we're about. There are other things as well, and I don't want to get into a long Calvinist discussion about who turns who, but I want to talk about Orwell just for a second. Does anyone know George Orwell? Any George Orwell fans here? He was one of the great writers of the first half of the 20th century, and no one spent longer thinking about the politics of language and the importance of language in public debate than George Orwell. If you want someone who's authentic, read some Orwell, because he didn't just write about stuff, he lived stuff. You know, you would never actually know. He went to Eton, which is like the most hoity-toity school in the UK. But he wanted to write about poverty, so he went and lived in joss houses and lived in, you know, homeless shelters for months at a time in order to be able to write about it authentically. You know, he was a committed socialist and believed in the, you know, the socialist side of the Spanish Civil War. So he didn't go and write about it. He signed up. He took a bullet in the throat, which, you know, took him out of the war. So he was an authentic guy. But I'm going to talk about two of his books very briefly. He's one of his big things that he wrote in the sort of last couple of years of his life. He died of tuberculosis at a relatively young age in 1950. He was a committed socialist, but he was writing against what was encroaching into socialism then, which was totalitarian communism. And we sort of forget now, and we think that history all happened in the past, but, you know, how close the sort of mainstream left-wing parties in the UK came to embracing communism. And he wanted to argue against that coming in. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of similar to what we're on about, in the sense that we're arguing in the marketplace of ideas. We're arguing for a nuanced position of Christianity. We're not just arguing for any old religion. We're asking for a particular type, not this way, not that way, for a particular thing. And that's very complicated to sort of get people, you know, worked up about and to inform people on. And he wrote two books on that. The first one was 1984, which I'm sure many people were forced to read at some stage at school or somewhere. Incredibly influential book, coined the phrase Big Brother, amongst many other things. But the other book was Animal Farm. Now, 1984 was kind of a diary almost of just an everyman character, Winston Smith, and what his life looked like under totalitarian communism. And Animal Farm dealt with, you know, what happens to the leaders in this situation? They might start out noble, but what happens to people down the line in that sort of setup? You know, how does power corrupt? What's amazing, and I don't know if anyone's read Animal Farm here, is it's written as a barnyard fable. Apart from the fact that there's a little bit of violence at the end, I could read that to my kids as a bedtime story and they would think nothing of it. So what I'm trying to say with that is avoiding cliche and avoiding sort of plastic comments doesn't mean you have to do it dumb. You can do it smart, and you can, I mean, these are two of the most influential books of the 20th century. You can write a barnyard fable that looks like that. And I think, you know, heck, we look for outside the Bible for inspiration. You look inside the Bible, there's plenty of stories, the story of Jonah, the story of all these things. There's so much great narrative in the Bible that's done that way because it's memorable, you understand it, and it, you know, it preaches good stories. And, you know, I was going to have this whole section, which I realised when Toby said I had 12 minutes, I had to cut. He wrote a wonderful essay, about a 10-page essay called Politics in the English Language, which has a whole bunch of rules for how you should write. And but I think just a little quote out of that, which is that the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. And I think for us, we need to be sincere. When we talk to people, when we discuss amongst ourselves the Bible, when we talk about God, we need to be sincere in what we're doing. And we need clear language for that. So ultimately, what does all that mean for us? I don't think we should tolerate cliche and excessive jargon at our church. We're generally leaders of our church, so I don't think we should provide them. So all these things start at the top that, you know, we shouldn't provide them effectively. But we're not just leaders in our church, we're also members of our church. We also sit in the congregation, we sit around a table at a Bible study, and so we shouldn't tolerate them. And so in our armour, we should have just a couple of really simple questions. And when anyone starts talking about that sort of thing, just ask simply, what do you mean by that? Can you explain that in plain English? And hammer that a point home. Put that into plain English. And don't let people go until they explain something. I just finished in my own time reading through Malachi, and the thing that struck me from Malachi is that God, above everything else, seems to hate hypocrisy and insincerity. And so I just want to finish with that quote that, you know, one of our great weapons against insincerity is clear language. And we need to look for that at all parts of our church. Thanks for your time.